Hi, fellow geochemists and geochemistry enthusiasts. Welcome to Geochemist Tea, the only podcast for people who love geochemistry with a side of tea. Our mission is to inspire aspiring geochemists and to introduce our listeners to niche geochemistry topics. I'm your host, Sam Scher, and this month we're talking with Rob Bowell about geochemical mining and how mining companies are starting to think about recovering metals from mine waste and by in-situ methodologies. Rob is a corporate consultant at SRK Consulting. Rob, welcome to Geochemistry.
Thank you for the invite, Sam. and I have my tea here.
Excellent. And for those of you that will not know this, me and Rob have been now talking for about 50 minutes about things that just don't even matter. So thanks for chatting. Rob is a geochemist with over 30 years of experience spanning industry to academia and environmental geochemistry to process engineering. Rob, usually I give a bit more background than this, but you have so many specialities and experiences that I think it would be much more interesting to narrate your own life here. So could you tell us about your experience, perhaps sprinkle in some advice for our young listeners who are itching to get into geochemistry?
I think geochemistry is like any part of the earth sciences. The most important skill is the ability to observe. And the second most important skill is to get out in the field and watch geochemistry in action. Chemistry in action can be looking at the reaction of lava with already formed rocks. It can be looking at dispersion of a gas within the atmosphere or the weathering of rocks on the coast by seawater. It could be going to a geothermal hot spring and looking at the sediments, which are the basis of many mineral deposits to form. It can be walking in the mountains and observing the differences between rocks from their colors to the crystals and the minerals which form them, to looking at what kind of lichen dominate on one rock type over another. All of these are various aspects of geochemistry. And that field observation is the basis by which we understand anything in earth science. And so that's the most critical aspect, I think. And obviously with that is look at the minerals which form these rocks. And to do that, you need a good hand lens. So I'd tell any geochemist to get a good hand lens and look at rocks through it.
That's some good advice. I can't say that I ever forget my hand lens in the field, but I don't think I appreciate it as much as you have just described, which is strange considering how much I work in mineralogy.
There you go. Oh, buy a good book as well in geochemistry. That's always very important.
Oh, yeah, I have lots of books.
I won't give you a plug because there are so many good books out there in geochemistry that are worth reading.
What's your top two?
So the top two that I own, I've got an original version of Goldschmidt's Book on Geochemistry in 1934. And then the other one, gosh, it's very hard to say. There's just so many good books out there. I like Posmer and Apello, Introduction to Groundwater Geochemistry. Drever's book on natural water geochemistry is an excellent book. Pete Williams' book, Oxide Zone Geochemistry. I could read that like a novel. It's so well written and is written as much for enthusiasts in mineralogy as it is for geochemists. And if you're a geochemist and you can't be inspired after reading his book, then you're in the wrong science. Don Langmuir's book on environmental geochemistry is so much more than just saying of environmental geochemistry. It's basic foundations in the application of chemistry to the earth sciences. And that's a good book worth reading. Konrad Krauskopf's book was the first one that I ever had as a textbook in geochemistry. And I still refer to that book almost 40 years after I purchased it. There is an update that was done by Professor Bird who was one of his PhD students. And that's also an excellent book. So go find one you enjoy reading.
I love that. And so how did you get into geochemistry then?
My route into geochemistry was by accident. I never intended going to university originally. I went to become an apprentice in the National Coal Board. And I very much had a track that I would become a coal miner. I had family members who were working in the coal mining industry in Northern England. And I thought I would qualify in that and then go and work in Africa. I'd had an uncle who'd done that and gone to Zambia, and he had great stories and great minerals and rocks that he'd collected there. And I'm a fanatical collector of minerals and have been since I was about 6 years old. So I was following that path. We had a strike in the UK, and that really was the end of me going into the coal mining industry. So I had to look to do something else. And so I applied for various courses. I thought I might do mining engineering, but the university that I applied to for that had to cancel the course because it had so few uptake. And I was given the offer of becoming a civil engineer, which I really didn't feel inspired to do. And so I ended up selecting chemistry and geology as a joint honours degree at Manchester. And I was very fortunate that I had as a tutor Jack Zussman of the DHZ mineralogy fame. And because he used to tutor the joint honours students, which whittled down to me by the end of the first year, I was given a lot of his time. And he was a charming, consummate academic who inspired me to look further into mineralogy in particular, but also into geochemistry. I had some excellent lecturers at Manchester University, like Richard Patrick and John Essen, who opened up geochemistry as a topic. John Wadsworth, who was a volcanic petrologist, who would provide papers in igneous geochemistry to me. And I had lecturers there who went that extra mile, who, if you were interested, would provide additional information, would provide access to the laboratories when I had minerals that I couldn't identify. They would organise for me to use the XRD, the SEM, and that's as an undergraduate. And so I was very fortunate that I had those kind of inspirational teachers. I left university with first class honours, and I ended up going to work for a year or so in the mining industry. In Southwest Africa, as it was then, Namibia. And then from there, went, applied for and got accepted for an MPhil course, which converted into a PhD at Southampton University, where I was able to study the geochemistry of the supergene environment, focused particularly around gold, but also around the ideas of sulfide oxidation and tropical weathering, groundwater geochemistry. And that really became the basis of, and still is the basis for my research interest. And it's the application of that geochemistry to problems, to mining projects that I still enjoy today. And post-PhD, I got more involved in applying mineralogy and chemistry in a processing environment, initially at a smelter and then with heap leaching. And then into geometallurgy or process mineralogy, as we used to call it. Not quite as sexy a term as geometallurgy. And I've been very fortunate to work in the mining industry for the whole of my career with various mining companies. And for the last 28 and a half years with SRK Consulting and seconded to various mining companies and being able to have long secondments. So that I've had the opportunity to live in different places, different cultures, and learn a great deal from the people who were my hosts.
That's
so perhaps another lesson to aspiring geochemists is don't be afraid to travel and relish every opportunity of it. If some of the situations are hair-raising.
I guess what's really interesting right now is this dichotomy, because there's this whole thing where we have such a low enrollment in geology, in geochemistry, and people are like, what's the future of mining? But then there's also this part where a lot of the listeners of this podcast are very much so like, how do I become a geochemist? How do I get into the field? How do I get hired? And so just with your experience, besides having a good hand lens, is there anything that you can recommend to them for ways that they can really break into geochemistry and find employment as such?
The foundations of geochemistry are very much embedded in physical and inorganic chemistry. So if you don't enjoy empirical chemistry, geochemistry is probably not for you. If you're looking for a degree course to do, there are very few undergraduate geochemistry degrees, but certainly there are some very good honors chemistry and geology courses, which are worth taking. There are many master's options in geochemistry, both by tuition and by research. And that's a good avenue into it. In the UK, there's perhaps less of a culture to automatically go to a graduate degree like there is perhaps in North America. And so in North America, I think the avenue into geochemistry is perhaps a little bit easier. You can go and get a chemistry degree from a college and then go on to a university which teaches a master's course which has geochemistry in it. And I think that's a good avenue to follow. I didn't do it, but I think perhaps I had my time again. I would actually look to do a master's degree. I did an MPhil, but it was by research. And I did it as a transition to PhD. I think I lost a lot by not doing a master's course that was by tuition focused on geochemistry. I think my undergraduate degree course was good, but I think I could have been better had I spent that extra year. I think there's a lot that's taught on master's courses, which is taken for granted or ignored at the PhD stage. Now, in North America, the general transition is you get a master's before you go to a PhD. In Europe, and particularly in the UK, very often you enroll for an MPhil to convert it to a PhD or straight for it to a PhD. And I think there's a gap in being an undergraduate to going to a PhD that I think if I did it again, I would want to do that extra year of education. And I think there's a lot that's taught on those master's courses, which is very worthwhile. Is a PhD necessary? No. I employ people in SRK who just have an undergraduate degree. They don't have a master's, they don't want to go and get one, and they don't need to. They're learning on the job. But I do think a master's degree in geochemistry is a big advantage. A PhD isn't an advantage. A PhD you do purely because you enjoy the subject and you want to focus on a very small part of it for 3 years.
Or in North America's case, 6 to 7.
Actually, no, your supervisors would still aspire that you do it in 3 years. It's just you have better coffee shops in North America.
Don't tell that to an Australian.
That's oh, really they good definitely advice. Have very poor coffee shops in Australia. They're nowhere near as good.
Wow. I think 25% of the listenership is from Australia, so I can't wait for them to hear this.
They make good tea in Australia. In the US, you do not know how to make a decent cup of tea.
Absolutely not. We make good iced tea.
Yeah, you have no concept of what boiling water is. Whereas no. Australians now have to make an excellent cup of tea. So
okay.
Each culture has their own niche.
I love that. Look, so on this topic of making fun of cultures, lightly, I really appreciate this introduction that you gave us, and I find it really both very interesting and I think very helpful to people. So I thank you for that. Now it's time for my favorite segment, which is tea time. And right now, speaking of tea, the kettle is hot and it's time to spill. What have you brought to us?
So you asked for a topic, and one I think that geochemists should look at is our ability to help the global metal cycle. There's a lot of discussion in current society about recycling, about good stewardship, about being sensitive to the environmental footprint that we all have, not just in the extraction industry, but globally as a society. Historically, societies have executed mines very poorly in the belief that there's always more land. There's always a green field somewhere else. And so we've left a legacy for ourselves, not just of areas which are contaminated, but also areas of potential. There are, in my 30 odd years, I've known of two mines which were closed because they were completely exhausted of ore and there was no trace of mineralization left in them. The rest have stopped working for many other reasons. It could be economic, that the ore that remains is no longer rich enough in grade or is more complicated to be mined or processed than the metal value will support. It could be environmental, that there was an impact to the environment. And society, local society, put pressure to close the operation down. A good example would be the current politics in Ecuador and Panama, which is against mining. And so there's a very modern mine that wouldn't impact the environment, that was had incredible investment put into it to design it so it was sensitive, so it was efficient. And because of politics in Panama, it's been at least temporarily shut down. And that's a mistake, because it should learn from the past. We have opportunity with modern technology to go back to many of these older mining areas and remine not just the ore that was left in the ground, but also the wastes. And not necessarily just for the commodity of interest. It could be for the waste material, which now has economic value. A good example is today I was talking with colleagues about a possible bauxite project. And the red mud, which has been built up over decades at this particular bauxite facility where it's been processed. Now, red mud is often given as an example of wasteful mining, that there's large volumes of waste produced from it. But actually, this particular red mud has been identified as being very rich in scandium, gallium, rare earth elements, and also lithium. Remember, this is a tropical weathering of granitic rocks. So they actually concentrate many of the elements that we associate with granite as being anomalous. And so with modern technology, we're now looking at ways in which we can make more efficient use of that waste, mine it, recover valuable commodities, and then the waste material we produce from that, if it meets environmental standards, we can actually produce bricks from it because it's a clay-rich material. Or we can dispose of it in a better engineered facility so that it's not a potential impact for the future. Whereas the current impoundment of this red mud is leaking, has contaminated groundwater, will continue to contaminate the area if it's left undeveloped. And importantly, it's sterilized a portion of land in a land where there is a very high growing population and a need for more land. So by cleaning up these mine sites, by stabling the waste, by correctly closing any mining facilities, we can free up the land as well to be used again for agriculture, for recreation, for housing, for multiple uses. And so by looking at the nature of wastes and looking at the demand for land or the demand for water, we can actually reuse the legacies of the past. And I say the water because, again, society is growing. In many parts of the world, we have climates which are becoming more arid or semi-arid, more seasonally dry. In many of these places, there are bodies of water within old mines, be it as a flooded underground mine or as an open pit. That is a resource, that water. Now, it might not be the quality of water you would like to drink at the moment, but by using the technology we have, we can treat that water, we can remove salts. That could include potassium, which we need for fertilizer, or phosphate, or nitrate. It could include removing sulfate that we can make use of in fertilizers. And we can make use of these materials and at the same time reduce the environmental footprint of these old mining operations and make them more efficient. And in that way, over a period of time, we can reclaim the land, we can redevelop the land around the mine site, and we can either recover it back to nature, or we can make use of a brownfield site for society, for some other purpose. And so when we look at the idea of mining old mine sites or mining mine waste, there are multiple benefits that come from it that all affect that bottom line that people like to talk about. It's not just the value of the historical commodity. A good example, perhaps, is in South Africa. Have you been to South Africa, I'm going to guess?
Yes.
And if you'd gone to Johannesburg when I first went there in the 1980s, you would have been struck by the large number of mine shafts that were present and the large amount of mine tailings, very large tailings impoundments, over 150, 200 meters high. And they were several football fields in size, and they sterilized large parts of the city. Since the gold price increased in the 1990s, there's been an attempt to remine, to reprocess these impoundments. And they've been taken, they've been reprocessed at plants like the Ergo plant that was owned by Anglo Gold historically. And they recover not only gold from it, but also uranium and pyrite to make sulfuric acid. And at the same time, they're able to clean up the historic tailing site and take the residual material that's left and place it in a modern facility that isn't going to fail, that isn't going to contaminate groundwater, and can be at some point closed, as some of them have already, recovered and turned into municipal parks or light use around the city. And so the actual physical appearance of Johannesburg as a city has changed enormously over the 35 years that I've been going there, almost 40 years now that I've been going there. And so that's an example of a very positive example of how we can restore mining areas and make use of the facilities that are there and make use of the benefits which are there. And this isn't just mines we can do this at. There's many chemical plants, historically chemical plants, which we use to preserve wood, to make furniture, and use the combination of copper and chromium and arsenic to treat the wood so that things like wood beetles wouldn't attack it. Those sites are heavily contaminated. Many former chemical plants have been abandoned and their sites are heavily contaminated. We can identify metals of value on those sites or chemical components. It could be potash or fertilizer, and we can recover those and at the same time clean up the land so that we can restore the environment and make better use of it as a society. And as our population continues to grow, I think these ideas will become more important.
Yeah, I've heard of, and I don't mean to not address any of the other universities that are doing research into this, but I've seen papers, University of Colorado, University of Arizona, Universidad de Chile, where these are active, particularly for the critical metals situation that everybody's pursuing right now with the reprocessing of old tailings and looking for this. I've heard of all of this, and it's very interesting that you're bringing this up right now, because I think it's such a good point for people to become more aware of, and definitely for investment, for the little that we can do from this podcast here. It's a really great point.
And as you say, there are a large number of groups working on this. I think my frustration at times is the immediate responses are recovering rare earth elements.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing rare about rare earth elements is an economic concentration of them. They are everywhere in nature. Almost every mineralizing system has concentrated them to some extent. But I think it's also, they're a very small component. Typically, rare earth elements are less than 1% of the primary deposit they were mined from, if they're a rare earth element mine. It's the rest of the material that we ignore. For example, while we're talking about rare earth elements, often the waste from a rare earth element is a carbonatite rock. That could be 40% or more nepheline, which is actually a good substitute for calcite in cement. And it has the benefit that when you make the cement, you're not releasing lots of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. It also has azurine in it. Now, azurine is a pyroxene mineral, as you're very aware of, I'm sure. And if we add some of this to the cement, we actually create a cement which is very tolerant of high temperatures. So we can use it in, say, an electricity plant. And we don't need to mine asbestos, which has obvious environmental impacts. And it can act as a retardant to flame. So we could use it for cladding on buildings instead of ones which are made out of plastics, which only add to humanity's impact to the environment. So there are many natural materials on these sites, which if we're a little more creative and we look a little bit more at the mineralogy and the chemistry of these, we could successfully recover and use as very worthy substitutes for synthetic materials that we produce as a society, which actually cause problems. We could recover barite from tailings associated with zinc and lead deposits for drilling muds. We could recover fluorite from there to produce hydrofluoric acid or for optical purposes. And so I think the change that I would hope we'll see in the next generation of geochemists is when they come to look at a mineral resource for a given mining project, it won't be cast as a gold project or as a copper project, but we'll see it more holistically as a potential chemistry plant, and that we'll look to recover all the value from an ore first time around, rather than going back and dealing with the tailings, and use as much as we can for benefit of society. And if that requires that commodities should cost more so that we can be a more frugal, more efficient, more sensitive society, then I think society should pay that price. As we grow in population, I don't think we'll have the luxury that the boomers had with their generation, that they felt there was a green field over the hill, so they could be wasteful. I think millennials, Gen Z, are much more aware of this than earlier generations and are much more concerned about efficient use of the world's resources rather than just banning the use of world's resources. It's an interesting point, but if we were to take the coal-powered stations, which discharge so much carbon dioxide into our atmosphere, and just build more efficient scrubbers to take the carbon dioxide and also the water vapor out of the discharge from them, then they wouldn't have an effect on global warming. We could recover those commodities. We could pump carbon dioxide into the ground to pump it into water. And if it's being pumped into an alkaline or a neutral pH water, it will form bicarbonate. It would neutralize acidic drainage. And we could start to make the most efficient use of the resources we have. We have ample coal resources in many parts of the world. It's not the coal which is causing the problem. It's the method by which we utilize it, which is the problem. And it's because society, by and large, is both selfish and lazy. So we're not prepared to put in the investment or the work to be more environmentally sensitive. It's very easy to blame fossil fuels for the ills of our planet, but it's not fossil fuels which have caused. They were here far before we were. It's humanity's lack satirical use of those resources and our very poor engineering, which is impacting our environment, and the fact there's a large number of us on the planet now.
I heard a lot in what you just said, but I heard mostly that we can blame engineers.
No, I wouldn't go that far. That's probably very true. We can blame engineers for many things, but engineers only do what society asks them to do. And society wants cheap engineering. We want cheap goods. We want cheap power. And because of that, we as a society govern those shortcuts over the last 50 to 100 years of urbanization of our species. And we have caused these impacts by our laziness, by our selfishness, to have things as cheaply as possible. And if we can't get them in our neighborhood as cheaply as possible, we're prepared to pay the cost of having it shipped from the other side of the planet, where things are not so mined with environmental sensitivity or good stewardship. And we're prepared to ignore that because it's not in our backyard.
What's interesting too, because, oh my goodness, all the conferences for the past, say, decade have been so focused on the how different resources are more and more scarce. But it's interesting to think of, alongside of that, having sessions talking about how the mining industry can direct society in this way towards not just necessarily this mythical, at this point, greener future, but being more responsible so that we can work with also what we have and making our standards higher. You bring up so many things that are so complicated, because at any given point, there's so much economics involved. And as you rightfully point out, everything is about how do we get this cheaper, but changing the view of society, and not just how they view the mining industry, but also us as the mining industry demanding of them these things, these different points that you bring up, I think poses a great challenge, but also something that perhaps us as millennials and people below the Gen Z, our amigos, as something that maybe that we can achieve. So it's all very fascinating. And well, I don't think that I've ever quite looked at it that way.
I'm very confident that you will. I'm very privileged to say I'm a father to four who actually count as millennials. And I think they do have a different view than my generation, Gen X, have, or previous generations, on how to conduct their lives. They're more in tune with a balance between work and life. They are less fearful of losing their career, which one career for life or one job for life. They are more flexible. They are less materialistic, I think, by and large, as a group. Except when it comes to their iPhones, of course. Those you have to be very materialistic. But I think by and large, there is a need for society as a whole to recognize that we have the understanding and we have the solutions to using all of the resources we have on our planet. I think it's gross ignorance for a group to shout, just stop oil. Oil in itself is not the problem. The problem is that we choose to build cars which don't collect their discharge. We choose to be polluters as society. I think by and large, society is grudging at best to pay for recycling in our waste disposal. And we throw away a huge resource, whether it's broken glass, which could be crushed down, remelted and used as glass again, or cardboard, which would prevent us having to chop down more trees, or taking food waste and turning it into fertilizer, because it's not expedient for us to spend time to separate it into different trash cans. Even separating cans. And unfortunately, it's not just individuals where this problem exists. A few years ago, I did a project outside of mining, which is unusual, and I was doing some work on a potential landfill site in the UK. I was shocked to find out in this particular part of England that because of the high volume of waste disposal, although they'd asked and handed out separate plastic bags for people to put recyclable material in, they threw it all away into the same landfill because it was too expensive for the council at that time to bother with recycling.
It's the same on Long Island. I'm from New York. And while I don't personally have ties to the garbage industry, I also have ties to the garbage industry. And it's not common knowledge, but also nobody's hiding it. But
An expose. You hear it first.
On Long Island also goes to landfills because it's expensive. And there's, that's trash a different thing. Expose. Yeah. So the trash industry itself.
Tomorrow morning, New York honestly, go. He'll be asking Trump. It's was not. He aware?
Trump is not of the correct ethnicity here to know the answers to this, but
he'll be blamed for it. Don't worry.
Yeah, there's an expose for sure on Netflix or Hulu about this. But yeah, the New York garbage industry.
On Netflix, it will be dramatized, okay?
Absolutely. I just watched one on the Gambino crime family recently. Well, exactly. The New York garbage industry.
There we go. That was The Sopranos as well, wasn't it? Yeah. They were into garbage as well. Yeah.
Exactly.
There you go. The point is, we choose as a society, those people who campaign about Just Stop Oil, they still went to Starbucks because I saw them in the various photographs holding Starbucks caps made out of a water-resistant cardboard, which has a plastic coating. Where did that plastic come from? From hydrocarbons, from oil, from actually the waste of the oil. But it's so integrated into our society to use these products. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. What's a bad thing is our lack of responsibility for what we purchase. And in the same way, I would mirror it with the historical lack of responsibility in how we close mines. Now, one of the problems with the mining industry as a whole is it really sucks at telling positive stories. With the mining industry as a whole allows NGOs to paint a very negative image of mineral extraction. But I would say over the transition of my career, and certainly over the last two decades, mining companies are acutely aware of the waste they produce and how they should manage it. They're very sensitive to the idea that there's value locked up in that waste and they would like to recover it. They're very sensitive to the idea that waste might impact the environment. And they have funded a lot of applied research and a lot of consultants to find solutions to these problems. And I, for one, would like to say I'm personally very grateful to all my clients for paying for my time and providing my salary to do that. I have a vested interest. I'm not separated from this. I have a very vested interest in mining companies doing well, especially those who are my clients.
And I would say to all mining companies, as a resident of Washington, D.C., I don't currently do this, but I'd be happy to act as an advocate on your behalf in the Capitol. No problem.
And you could give the good news stories.
Exactly.
Spend a lot of money looking at this. I was working for one mining company, still am, in Sweden, where they have a rare earth element project. When the project first came to us, it came to us from their CEO with the idea of how could he utilize more of the waste? Because 99.5% of what he was going to mine was going to be waste. And it was in a sensitive environment. So he paid for a study where we reimagined his mine. And we found outlets for much of the rock that he would mine. They wouldn't be particularly valuable. They were industrial minerals. But they were minerals that had use and benefit. And so by modifying the process, first off, the part of the process, which would be in use intense energy and intense chemical reagents, that we moved to another part of the country, which was a brownfield site with an existing chemical industry. So we wouldn't be bringing chemicals to what was a pristine, sensitive environment. Also, the waste, which would be permanently there, that was moved off site to this brownfield site where we could compact it, where we could close it in a suitably engineered facility that wouldn't be a problem. And the mine itself on site had a much smaller footprint. We were going to sell 85% by the time we finished of all the materials that were mined. The other 15% at the end of mine life wouldn't be left on the surface as a pile. They would have been placed back into the open pit. And because of the nature of the environment in that area, that would have filled with water. We would have put a cap over that mine waste so it wouldn't interact with that water. So the water would be pristine and would become a natural resource to that community, which was a sparse rural mining community. Mining companies are going that extra mile now. Mining companies are looking at how can I reduce my footprint? How can I reduce the waste that I produce? How can I recycle what I have on this mine? Even down to spending a lot of money on looking at how to recycle water. What technology do they need so that they don't evaporate off lots of water? 10, 20 years ago, it was common for mines to have a large number of snowmakers, the evaporators, especially very arid environments. Now, we try to see how we can minimize the amount of water that we pump out of the ground and how much can we recycle from it. But society isn't aware of that because we don't talk about it. And it's a shame because that change in attitudes over my career are very important because they reflect a changing attitude, hopefully, in society as a whole, that we can no longer look for a green field the other side of the hill. because there isn't one. And that we need to ensure that where we're living, where we're working, that we get the best use out of the land with the smallest footprint.
I have to say, this has been a delightful tea session. It's been very inspiring too. And again, I don't know what impact we can have on this little podcast, but at the same time, it's definitely something at least that I never thought that to really speak about before, but to definitely campaign on these different facets of the mining industry. I've definitely talked about how it's not the Colorado acid mine drainage of the past kind of thing, but at the same time to talk about it in these terms and to also think about going forward, it's not just a gold, a copper, or whatever resource. It's also what other rocks are coming in the ground that can do other things. It's totally fascinating, things I never thought about before. So I hope also for our listeners that they've gotten some inspiration out of this. Very cool, Rob.
I'll leave you with one story. Facet.
I love it.
All right. So the whole of the, I'm sure you're very much aware of the Superfund
system. Yes.
Which has given countless jobs to many consultants. Thank you, US taxpayers. It was caused by a mining company which badly managed or badly understood the nature of water during storm events in its mine. Now, at the time they were operating, there was no regulatory requirement for them to understand that. So like most mines at that time, they did the minimum. It caused a huge blowout. It contaminated the series of creeks. Now, in their defense, the names of the creeks it contaminated, like Dead Man's Gulch, Alum Creek, there was a name the old timers gave these names to these creeks. It was common because of the nature of the rocks and the presence of mineralized rocks in those areas that when there was storm events, these things happened and impacts happened. Superfund came along. And the best that the Superfund project could come up with was basically produce a sludge, which they put into a truck and they drive back up the hill and they dump in an open pit. But the water that's coming out of the attic that gets treated has more than $3,000 a day of metals being thrown away into this sludge. Now, the mine itself was a copper gold mine. There is copper in the water. It's very acidic, so it mobilizes copper, mobilizes cadmium and zinc. It has antimony, which is a critical metal in there. It has rare earth elements, which you already mentioned, which are also critical elements. It has rubidium and lithium. It has germanium in there. Rather than simply building a water treatment that treated the immediate problem, the EPA had the opportunity to go one step better and look to see if they could recover the value from that water. They didn't. They mirrored society in that they were lazy and they tried to do things for the lowest possible cost. I would hope in the future that somebody will come along to that site in Colorado and they will look at Summitville as an asset, not as a liability, and that they will find a means by which they can reprocess that sludge and process the water so they can recover all those elements of value so that they can supply part of society's need for specialist metals, which are present in that system and which are currently being sterilized by poor management and lack of imagination. So, acid mine drainage in Colorado doesn't to be just a liability. It can be a resource. And the key to that happening is geochemistry.
Hear that, students? All right, I love it. What we're going to do now is we're going to talk a little bit, or a lot of it, we'll see, about a paper that you had recommended to me. And really, the underlying themes of this paper, which actually you published yourself as an abstract. But it was definitely fascinating, especially since it's not usually something that I would read into. The title of this paper was called The Natural, the Vadoso, Nature's Gift to Mine Closure. And I think just to start, could you just take us through really the title of this and really what the paper goes on to talk about? And then from there, we'll just discuss.
I've got to correct you. So I didn't publish it myself. It is I consider it a full paper. It was 14 pages. Mm-hmm. And it was published as part of a conference held in Reno, Nevada last year in the conference proceedings of Mine Closure 2023. Again, the mining industry sponsored that conference. A very good friend of mine did an excellent job organizing the conference, Jeff Parsley, and he's a guru in mine closure himself. And so they pulled together extremely good conference with people coming from all over the globe to talk about issues related to mine closure. And not just is there a problem, but more importantly, what the solutions are and how the industry and how society should both approach the idea of closing mines and what to do with them as a legacy. So Jeff very kindly invited me to be a keynote speaker, which meant I could pick any topic to talk about. And he wanted it, one of them, to be lent towards geochemistry. And I thought I could talk about all the problems that come out of a mine. But really what I was to talk about was the solutions. And one of the solutions is actually a geochemical one. And we, as human beings, have nothing to do with it. These are natural processes by which metals are limited in their transport in the environment. Now, if metals weren't limited in their transport in the environment, we would never have had all these ore deposits in the first place, because that's how they form, by becoming trapped or enriched in certain areas. So this paper is looking at the zone above groundwater, which is the one that we mostly interact with as human beings, where we farm, where we live, where we grow crops, where we have our animals, often in very arid environments where they recover seasonal water from. And within this zone, it's an active zone of chemistry in which chemical elements can be both mobilized and also trapped. And so this paper goes through the various processes that we can look at. It starts with very simple ones like neutralization, which is where you have a very acidic water that can mobilize metals, that contacts a rock, which has minerals in it, which are very reactive with acids, such as calcite. And so it precipitates them out. There's a very common natural analog in that, in the weathering profile of a sulfide mineral deposit, where the elements get mobilized as sulfides oxidize, generate acid. They react with minerals, be it carbonates or silicates, and precipitate out their loads to create zones of supergene enrichment, which historically were the bonanza ores that were mined in the 19th century. It looks at some of the limitations in terms of rates, in terms of reactivity and grain size associated with those minerals. And then went on to talk about volatilization. Some chemicals like ammonia, carbon dioxide, and hydrogen cyanide are all highly volatile. And so in the natural environment, they convert from a solid or from a liquid into a gas, and so are released. And so the concentration is reduced. There's controls by biological processes. This can stretch from reaction with simple organic acids released by organisms, or it can be the role of algae or bacteria or lichen, which are a form of algae, which have the ability to incorporate metals into their structure or utilize them as nutrients and buffer water chemistry. One of the most attractive ones I know is a thing called a kiss plant, an orchid, Corara vulgaris, and it can incorporate divalent cation metals in its structure. And you can tell which ones it collects by the color of the flower. So if it's in a cobalt-rich soil, it's pink. If it's in a copper-rich soil, it goes a very nice blue. And if it's in a nickel-rich soil, it goes green. And if it's in an iron-rich soil, it forms a yellow to slightly white-colored flower. And so many biological organisms can interact with chemistry of mine water, and so improve that chemistry and limit any potential reaction with the environment. I then talk about chemical methods of adsorption and precipitation, which are probably volumetrically the most important ones in many soils. I give an example of arsenic as a chemical element, which is sensitive to interaction with its environment. And I talk about a natural analog site, a wonderful former mine mineral project in Southwest Africa, where I first worked at SUMEB, where there's a host of over 400 different minerals, most of which are formed in the oxide zone and are a product of sulfide oxidation acid rock drainage being neutralized in carbonate and silicate rocks. And we can look at these natural processes to see how we, and if we understand them, we can then mimic them in order to clean up the environment. And that could be around a mine site or around an industrial site. It could be a better method or more efficient method of coal washing, of soil washing than we currently do. The paper also gives some larger regional examples from Serbia, from Canada, from Brazil, where you can see these processes have taken place and have been important in the closure and in the mitigation of impacts around mine sites, both accidental and also how we've engineered them. And so it's a paper which tries to provide some encouragement to assess natural processes. And much as I said about mining, if we understood nature better, we would be able to mimic it and we would be more efficient and perhaps have a smaller footprint. And again, it takes geochemistry to understand that.
And in this, have you seen any kind of research and development that's been going on either within mining companies, consultancies, or in academia that is really taking these processes to heart to try and, as you say,
there's a library of papers on the basic science now.
And
there's also applications, for example, the development of what we term passive treatment of mine water, where we mimic natural processes of precipitation and neutralization to clean up mine drainage using a combination of reed beds and limestone drains. And yes, we have developed as an industry, as a society, methods in which to do this, to stabilize mine waste, to stabilize impacts from metals on the environment, and so clean them up. Some of them are still in their infancy. Some of them are still being studied. But at least that's being done. Unfortunately, the nature of scientific funding for non-military purposes in the Western world is at an all-time low. And chemistry tends to come way down below medicine, microbiology, and social sciences, unfortunately, were the last ones to get grants. So it's not perhaps as advanced as it could be.
That's so fascinating, just thinking about the research end and seemingly how simple perhaps it could be to make that jump from where we are now to the next stage of really implementing, but just the lack of funding. What do you think about, there's the different exploration consortiums with universities. Are there any universities that have consortiums with companies in the environmental sector that could also be helpful for academia for studying these processes?
Oh, there are. There are individuals more than perhaps whole research groups in geochemistry. Queen's University, where I'm an adjunct professor, has a group of professors there who are very interested in researching stable isotopes and the application of stable isotopes in understanding earth processes. There's a very strong research group looking at mine impacts at Waterloo under David Blows. There's a very good group in Queensland, which is multidisciplinary, that's working with many of the Australian mining companies. So there are certainly groups around, and there are more importantly individuals around who are carrying out this research, and often these groups do cross-fertilize and they do collaborate and so on, and they collaborate with the mining companies. Perhaps some of the challenges at times is getting the recognition, is getting the right forum they can disseminate this information. And as I said, mining companies really are quite poor at telling good news. So mining companies do a lot to support research, to support societies, to support social and educational and health programs in many parts of the world. But we don't consider it, for some reason, newsworthy. And so we don't talk about it. And perhaps we should talk about it more. We should explain what we're doing, that we're, it's not just some faceless organization that is simply trying to accumulate as much wealth in as short a period of time, and therefore not aiding either the societies in which they work or the societies which they contribute to those metals. Whereas the reality is quite different, and mining companies are acutely sensitive to the societies that they live and work in. And the mining employment model has changed very much over the last two decades. Whereas perhaps 20, 30 years ago, most of the positions on mines in developing countries were expatriates. Now the majority of those people are from the local environment. They've gone to university. The mining companies have paid for them to have not only an education, but then employment afterwards, and they've risen through the ranks. And there are probably more mines in places like Africa and South America now, which are managed by locals rather than by expatriates. And I would say it's the exception these days to see an expatriate in those positions.
I think you make a really good point from having worked abroad and then also working with companies in places like Africa, Southeast Asia, even, and seeing that structure. That is, I never really thought of it that way, but that's a really good point about it being the exception for expats to hold so many positions. Yeah. No, and I think it's this one thing where I think that maybe it's in mining companies, maybe are just so used to being on the end of, you know, the battery, exactly, where they're just like, oh, if we just keep quiet, then nobody will notice us. And that's better than just saying, hey, look at how good we're doing now and pulling the attention back. But maybe it's just, we just really have to change that so completely at this point, because this isn't working for us either.
I would say quite happily, quite proudly, I'm very proud to work in the mining industry. I'm very proud of the work I've done. I'm proud of the work that I see colleagues do and the mining companies do, the way they support those who invest in them, the rules that they're obligated to follow, and the way they've developed perhaps is a shadier part of our history. But certainly I would say the generation that are now employed within the mining industry fully embrace those rules and live by them. The way we support the communities in which we mine and those societies, the way we interact with governments on a fair but honest basis. Perhaps in times past, the use of brown paper envelopes to curry favor was an unfortunate practice. Now it's definitely a taboo, and mining companies would not do that. And so I think the industry itself is a very organized, very professional, very ethical industry. And really, I think you'd be hard pressed to find an industry which has gone through such a transition as a company. I know if you were to go into the food industry or accounting or even large multinational legal firms, how many of them have a CEO which has come from the parent company, and even a senior management team from the parent company in another country? Whereas in the mining industry, we're much more sensitive to having a senior management team and executives from the countries in which we're operating.
And you talk a lot about the society part, which I find super fascinating. But I think also one thing that I find that I'm very proud to be part of the mining industry in as well is that we, while it is still very, somebody that works in the field, it is still very challenging, but we also, we embrace technology in ways which I don't think is seen so much when I talk to a lot of other friends in different industries, right? If you're outside of the tech industry, I don't really see it being as applied as where we, especially I work more in the exploration and geomet space, and we're always looking for solutions to our problems. And we accept the fact that this isn't going to come from what we were doing even 10 years ago. And we're looking for ways to constantly innovate. And I find that's really telling of who we are as a culture. And that's one of my favorite parts about being in mining, is that we're forced to, and we accept it, and we do it.
We have had mistakes. We're human beings. And historically, perhaps we would have tried to gloss over those mistakes. But even where they're treacherous, and the very tragic collapse of a heap leach in Turkey at the start of this year, the mining company itself reacted very quickly to it. They sought to rescue those who were trapped. They sought to help those who were injured. They sought to restrict the impact of the event to as small an area as possible. So I think the mining industry is very responsive when things like that happen. Even in Brazil, where there was this tragic loss of life due to a tailings impoundment failure a few years ago, on two separate occasions, both times the mining companies were willing to work with the government. They didn't get protective. They were honest and open about what happened. And you can find multiple academic papers of studies done around the impacts, what went wrong, why it went wrong, and what could be done in the future to mitigate those impacts. The mining industry is very good at learning from this. The failures in Brazil generated the whole global standards on tailings management, which are now, although not a legal obligation in most jurisdictions, they are a voluntary obligation, which most mining companies now adhere to. So we're very good at learning. We're very good at changing our ways and very quickly, which is a good thing.
It's a good thing. Look, I think we've covered a lot of the globe here at this point, but getting a little bit back to a bit of your paper in the sense of all the different case studies you talk about, but it's very clear for anybody listening that you've worked all over the world at many different mine sites. And one of the things that I couldn't help but wonder as I was reading through this paper was just really what was the most extreme example that you've seen of this kind of natural attenuation that's been happening? And also at the same time, maybe what's the most interesting or the most bizarre?
I think the most extreme is perhaps the Sumo mine and the proliferation of secondary minerals formed in these wonderful carbonate rocks. Carbonate rocks are great. They not only neutralize acid, but because very often they have karstic forms, they have large open spaces to form beautiful minerals in them. So that's the most impressive, I think, of karstic
and where is it?
With mineral deposits. It's in Namibia. In God's own country, probably my favorite part of the planet.
Okay.
Northeast Namibia. And it's just an amazing mineral deposit, which I cannot tire of talking about all the minerals from there.
And so what do they mine for and what kind of minerals are you seeing?
Unfortunately, for various political reasons, the mine was shut in 1996 after almost 100 years of operation. It wasn't shut because it ran out of ore. It was shut for political reasons, really. The mine itself was at one point the world's largest lead producer. Mm. It was a significant copper producer in Africa. It's got its processed waste, which we call slag, from a smelt, is actually the world's largest known mineral deposit for germanium. It was enriched in gallium and indium, silver, molybdenum, cadmium, and a host of other metals as well. In terms of the most consistent one, perhaps, or the most useful one, I think within the Great Basin of Nevada in the western United States, the alluvium there is very interesting by the fact that it's so thick and it has significant potential for the attenuation of a number of metals and metalloids. Because of expandable clays within the soil horizons there, it can sequester divalent cations like copper and lead and zinc. And because of the abundant oxyferric hydroxides or hydrospheric hydroxides within the soil, it can sequester oxyanions or metalloids like arsenate or antimonate. And so that's a very useful material. I think peat soils tend also to be quite interesting in the way they attenuate because they have a high organic matter content. And peat soils in the arboreal forests of northern Canada, South Island, New Zealand, northern Russia, Scandinavia, all have this very significant potential to attenuate metals and metalloids, which is not only useful for the environment, but also can create very good geochemical signatures in exploration to identify buried mineral deposits. And there's the overlap. You talked about being an exploration geochemist. I've applied geochemistry in environmental purposes, in exploration, in resource development, in forensic science. I've I've applied my geochemistry in geometallurgy or process mineralogy, in geotechnical studies on mines, looking at compromised materials due to corrosion. And in all these, I would say I've applied geochemistry. It's not been one particular avenue, but it's been the same tools. It's been the same principles that I've applied. And they come down to understanding the fundamental mineralogical and chemical properties of the materials you're dealing with, be it be a rock, a water, or a soil.
That's so well said. Inspiration for everybody. So switching a little bit, but I've been working kind of adjacent to a mine closure project the last year. And this has been the first time in my career that I've done such a thing, as we've talked about all episode. But for me, really learning this over the past year, it truly is a fascinating science. So I was just wondering, you've been around for a little bit here, but really, what's been the biggest triumph in the application of geochemistry to this field, do you think? And do you really think that we've been truly successful to this point at remediating projects? Or are we really, for the most part, still just band-aiding a lot of things?
I think probably the biggest triumph for me is the fundamental demonstration that nature also has a role in mine closure, in that it can naturally deal with a certain portion of metal or metalloid or chemical reagent exposure without needing human interference. And I think fundamentally that's a triumph of geochemistry to be able to demonstrate that. I don't think we're a band-aid, because I think the mining industry is very sensitive in being good stewards and how it closes a site. I would say most miners recognize that there's no such thing as a wilderness anymore on our planet, that eventually every area has the potential to be colonized. And so when we close a site, we close it for good, or we close it with good management strategies and a fund to be able to pay for that. Now, in some cases, that might be, at the present time, the best technology we can apply is in perpetuity water treatment. For example, Berkeley Pit in Montana is a good example, or Summitville that we spoke about a few minutes ago. And that is the best technology we currently have available. Now, in the future, hopefully we'll improve on that. And it's geochemistry that helps to make that decision, not just in identifying quantum, but also the rates at which those elements are released and the rates at which they can be attenuated. And I think that we are successful in truly remediating projects. I was heavily involved in the closure of the San Manuel mine in Arizona. And I believe that is a well-planned, executed mine closure project. Geochemistry was a fundamental part of it, but it was a small cog. It went alongside studies on groundwater and surface water, understanding the economic geology of the site and the basic geological formations, the structural geology, the geotechnical stability of facilities and natural rocks. And all of that was dovetailed with the engineering and assessments of ecotoxicology, ecology, biological baselines within the area. So I think it's very hard to say what has geochemistry done. Perhaps the most important triumph is that we have multidisciplined approaches to each of these mine closures, which are, by nature of the fact that no two mines are the same, no two teams will be exactly the same either. And I do think that we have the ability and the demonstrated track record to be more than just a band-aid, to be able to close mines so they are closed and they are no longer a liability.
And I think that perfectly goes into my last question here, which is what your thoughts are about the outlook of remediation of all global mining sites. And really, I think you just answered that. But at the same time, any more philosophical thoughts you have, or truly based in science thoughts that you have, is how do we just do this more effectively? How do we even speed it up, if you will?
I'm tempted to say that the mines we closed today will probably be reopened tomorrow for other commodities that we missed. And we're seeing that at the moment in Cornwall, in Southwest England. There's a renaissance in the development of mines there to go back and remine them for lower grade tin. for fluorite, for base metals, which might not be mined in the first place, like zinc and lead. There's also an interest in going back into the huge China clay open cast areas around St. Austell, not for more China clay, but this time to go and extract lithium, which was previously ignored. And so I do believe that in many cases, we will go back and reopen these mines to go back and recover resources that at the time were waste and now have a value. As a very good friend of mine in the United States, John Barter, who's an environmental manager, who has a wonderful quote, "Waste rock is a material that we have yet to designate a value for." And so in that sense, I think there will be some recycling, and perhaps that's a good reflection on society, particularly as society grows, has a heavier demand for resources and different resources to those we've used traditionally as technologies change. I think, however, whatever we do, there will be more sensitivity, and I would certainly hope better understanding of how we interact with our environment in future generations of professionals, and that they will seek to minimize the footprint while maximizing the value of any exploitation that they undertake, and that the engineering involved will better utilize those materials. So maybe we can go back to having coal-powered stations because we build the right kind of exhaust on them to collect the fumes which otherwise would impact our planet, that we will be able to engineer our engines to use those engines which will still require petroleum or oil-based fuels, perhaps aviation fuels or marine fuels, will use them better with better control, with less or no emissions. So I would like to think that in the future, we will be more sensitive and we'll be more knowledgeable. And a little less greedy, perhaps.
You never know. We can hope. But look, I want to thank you so much for being here, Rob. And I really hope that you enjoyed talking about this on the show as much as I enjoyed learning about it and hearing a completely different perspective on things than I typically talk to people about. So I really want to thank you for that. And I want to thank everybody for listening to Geochemist Tea. Again, a big thanks to Rob for being on the show, dishing some tea and talking about revisiting our mine waste and even really just how the future of mining really should start to look like in terms of including society and all of our different steps, really. So also thanks to our sponsor, LKI Consulting, and to It's Water and Coma Media for our music. And I'm looking forward to chatting with everybody next month.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure. And you owe me lunch when I next come to DC.
I absolutely do.